How many of you brought your Bibles? Yeah, good for you guys. You all get bonus points for that. If you didn't, grab a Bible in front of you, and let's turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, probably a book that you're not as familiar with, I'm guessing, just simply from the fact that we don't often, when we're doing our devotional reading, turn to this book. The reason is it's a very dark, sobering book of the Bible. Ecclesiastes is the book from which we get this phrase, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. It is a very sobering book. It is a book where the truths of it come to us indirectly, where the hope that is found in this book, we have to see through it to what's beyond. But I think it is such a profound book and one that I'm really excited about us studying, because I think that it stretches us. It is going to stretch our faith. I think it's going to deepen our faith because it's a book of struggle. And I think that this is how faith grows. I think it's appropriate that we're beginning this book on 9/11. That's just kind of one of those things that happens, and I'm not saying there's a coincidence there, except that 9/11, as tragic as that day was, had this sort of effect on our nation where it shook us out of this sleep, at least for a few months. My Patty's cousin studied there in Juilliard at the time and said, gosh, Manhattan is like a different place after the attack. The friendliness and the generosity that it brought out of people. And it's interesting because I think all of a sudden people were asking questions that they hadn't been asking before, or questions that they were maybe distracting themselves from. And so there's something about tragedy, there's something about coming face to face with this that brings us to the idea of greater realities. Now, I think it's interesting too, you know, you've heard probably this buzz going around on Facebook about the fact that the clergy are not invited into the memorial services of this. And I think this is telling as well, that I think it points to one of the beliefs kind of underlying all of this, that maybe religion is what caused it. That these questions, there's no way of us breaking outside of this kind of religious bubble that we're in. And so all beliefs are subjective, and sometimes that leads people to do some pretty bad things. So when we come to memorialize that day, we're not going to invite pastors from here and not from here. And you get the point. But underlying it all is a sort of despair that says we can never get past our own sort of subjective ideals into something that really, truly has solidity to it. I mean, do you feel that? It kind of is the religion of the state. And what I love about Ecclesiastes, the author of this book, is going to say, if you can't break free from that, if you can't get some sort of revelation from beyond, then we're out of luck. That everything that we do here, all the rules that we set, all the little ways that we extend courtesy or discourtesy, all of that is just a game that in the end changes nothing. We studied Job a little while ago now, but I remember going into Job and thinking, oh man, this is going to be a heavy experience. And yet we found, I think, such hope in that book. And Job is basically a book about a man who has everything that loses everything and therefore has nothing, and finds that in the midst of all that nothingness, he's got everything, because God shows up and speaks, and he realizes, all right, I get it. Ecclesiastes, on the other hand, is a book of somebody who has everything, keeps everything, and in the end has nothing, and shows all the vain pursuits that we have in this life amount to so little. In fact, amount to zero is what he's going to tell us. It's a book of wisdom. And I think this is important, that the vain man doesn't know he's living in vanity. It's only the wise that understands folly. It's not the one caught up in the folly. We're going to talk about this later. But it is a book of wisdom. In that statement, all is meaningless. These are heavy words, words that we need to sit in, words that we need to not seek to avoid. There's a couple phrases that we're going to get in this book that are going to be important. This idea of vanity is not what we would think now is like staring in the mirror, some sort of narcissistic, you know, personality disorder. It's instead, vanity is meaninglessness. It's empty. It's worthless. It's to have this thing but realize that we're holding this husk or this shell. It's a book, as I said before, of philosophy. And there's really, in the Bible, one true book of philosophy, which is Ecclesiastes. And let me explain what I mean by that. Philosophy as opposed to revelation. In revelation, you have God reaching down and touching man. And this is one of the huge, profound things of this book. It's one of the reasons that we feel like we have truth beyond just my own imaginations of truth. Is that God reveals. But there's another aspect, and this aspect of philosophy, which just means the love of wisdom, is man reaching and extending a hand towards God. And as it turns out, this is a vital component of faith. It's not faith alone. Faith is not just some intellectual assent, but faith requires our minds, which is why we're told to love God with all of our minds. Paul tells us to not conform any longer to the patterns of this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. So it's our mind fully engaged that allows us to make distinctions, allows us to discern. And Paul is going to tell us, you've got to apply yourself to this task. In fact, there's no getting around the work required in thinking. And I think sometimes we have this misconception with church that it's a place to get all the answers, like a cram session for some sort of test that we're going to take. But we know that this is not actually education, right? To get all the answers to the test and get an A is vanity. To wrestle with the material and to thereby grow, to struggle with the questions and go deeper and deeper is bringing us into higher and higher levels of faith and understanding of God. This is what Solomon in Proverbs is pushing us towards. The depths of understanding and wisdom, Paul would say, the riches of the knowledge of the love of God. But it comes as a struggle. That shouldn't surprise us. You see that over and over and over throughout Scripture. This means we need to sit in the questions. And the book of Ecclesiastes is a book of questions. Over and over again, the question. But not just questions, but the questions. The most important ones. You can go around and question everything and drive yourself insane, but to be asking the questions, the deeper questions, the ones about what it means to be happy. What does it mean to be good? What does it mean to be just? What does it mean to be successful in life? What does it mean to be a good person, a good husband, a good father? All of these questions. What happens to me when I die? It's a good question. And sometimes, because we can't get an easy answer, or we can't get something that just immediately takes care of that sense of angst in us, we tend to avoid questions. You can't, but you could try. You can divert your attention away from those things, or distract yourself, or pretend they're not there. But the way that we live our life will reveal that as well. And I think that we see that so symptomatically in our culture that's constantly busy, constantly interrupting, constantly trying to take our minds off of something, whether it's television or it's alcohol or it's whatever it is. These ways of diverting ourselves away from the deep questions that are there. I love this from Pascal. He says, when I have thought about the various activities of men, the dangers and pains they face at court or in war, which give rise to so many quarrels, passions, bold and often bad ventures, etc., I have often said that man's unhappiness arises from one thing, and one thing alone, that he cannot remain quietly in his room. And that's kind of a surprise answer. You're expecting something a little bit more than that. And Pascal says, this inability for man to just sit there in quiet. Because when we do, number one, we become aware of all the things distracting us. But in there too, we're unable to avoid the realities of this that come kind of crashing in on us in the silence. I think that we can avoid these kind of things, unfortunately, through religion as well, and I think this is why it's important for us as a church to be going through a book like this. That I think that sometimes in our religious faith, we can stop asking questions. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't live with high levels of confidence and assurance of our beliefs. I'm not saying that. But that sometimes our faith or our religion becomes a way of escaping the hard questions by coming up with some sort of rote answer that allows us to avoid the struggle. I read in Merton where he was saying sometimes, you know, when you ask somebody about their beliefs in God, those beliefs are more telling about the person than about who God is. The things that we cling to for a sense of safety or assurance that are really just us avoiding the darker questions. He says, a faith that merely confirms us in opinionatedness and self-complacency may well be an expression of theological doubt. True faith is never merely a source of spiritual doubt. It may indeed bring peace, but before it does so, it must involve us in a struggle. A faith that avoids this struggle is really a temptation against true faith. And I'm really hoping this for us as a church in our spiritual journey together, that we become a church that is seeking after who God really is. Deeper knowledge and understanding of His love, deeper perspective on His will, His kingdom. We're coming asking these questions. But I think that sometimes we get so caught up in the answer that we don't spend the time and struggle with the question. I was thinking of this, Steve and I were talking about this idea of the questions of Ecclesiastes, and made me think of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. How many of you have read this book? Okay, like two of you, three of you. We can sit afterwards and create our little nerd Bible study or something. In this book, they build a supercomputer, which they label Deep Thought. And Deep Thought is going to come up with the answer of life, the universe, and everything. And so it takes it 7.5 million years to compute this answer. And it's this enormous computer, and it's crunching away and crunching away. So they're waiting in anticipation, waiting in anticipation. And finally, that day arrives, and the whole world kind of gathers, the whole universe gathers to hear the answer that Deep Thought has come up with. And they come that day, and they say, do you have an answer? And Deep Thought says, yes. Well, what is it? And he goes, you're not going to like it. No, tell us. What is the answer? And he says, okay. It's 42. And they're furious. 42, what are you talking about? And it says this, I'll just read. 42, is that all you've got to show for 7.5 million years of work? I checked it very thoroughly, said the computer. And that quite definitely is the answer. I think the problem, to be quite honest with you, is that you've never actually known what the question is. And I think that there's something in there for us, especially as a New Testament church. We know the answer, Jesus. And Jesus is the answer. The beauty of this is that I think we finish our study of Ecclesiastes right at Christmas, and I think that will be wonderful. But I think we're going to sit for the next 3 months in the question. And this was part of the problem as Jesus came forward with the gospel. He would say, look, if you've got ears, hear. If you got eyes, see. And I think if we're not asking the question, we go, what do I have to be forgiven of, Jesus? He comes down and says, look, I came to bring healing to the sick. But you go, I'm fine, thanks. And again, this inability to wrestle with questions causes us, I think, to fail to see the depth of the answers, just what Jesus brings, just why He is the key. And the very answer to the question. I think that the book of Ecclesiastes is going to help us to wrestle. And I think in that wrestling, it has the opportunity to tear down idols in our life. And I think this will be one of the real fruitful things it will bring. Not only in wrestling the questions with the questions, but applying those sort of things and realizing, where am I in my life striving after vanity, striving after things that are empty, striving after these idols. And before we get into our passage, I just read, it's only going to be one quote from Lewis today, but he says this: "The books or the music in which we thought beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them, it only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited." And I think that these questions, I think, will prove invaluable in allowing us to go through and spot where we are spending our lives on things that bring absolutely no profit. The book of Ecclesiastes. Real quick before we jump in, I think it's worth talking just about the author of this. Traditionally thought to be Solomon. Clearly, whoever wrote this meant it to be read as though Solomon was writing it. And whether it was Solomon or not, neither of those take away from the credibility of it. That would have been a very popular literary device if somebody was writing as Solomon. He never says Solomon in it, and that's a clue that somebody may be saying, look, when you read this, I want you to think of the most wealthy and wise king of Israel, right? It may have been somebody that fit that bill himself. He certainly is going to write about himself in the first person. But some of the language of this, people think, was written quite a bit later than the time of Solomon, and that may very well be true. Either way, I don't think that distorts at all the message that's being said. You know, Plato did this with Socrates, right? Socrates is a common voice in Plato's words. Whether Socrates ever said it or not, we're supposed to think of Socrates. And as we listen to this, we're supposed to think of Solomon. There's two people in here, two voices. The first is somebody that is considered to be kind of a framer of this. He gives us an intro and a closing. So the first half of chapter 1 and the second half of chapter 12, you're going to hear a different voice than the author himself. The teacher, the preacher, who comes in and writes basically from 1:12 to 12:7. And so you have two wise men in this. The wise man who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, and then also the one who is passing this on to his son. And so there's a father in here in the second wise man who wants to impart these words of wisdom to his child. Let's read the first 11 verses here. It says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along. And on its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. That which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see this, it is new? Already it has existed for ages, which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things and also of the latter things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still." See what I mean? Pretty dark stuff. This is the framer here saying basically this is what the whole book's about. You just got it there in 11 verses. The words of the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And again, vanity means meaninglessness, means emptiness. And he's going to go through here and give us some interesting pictures out of nature, I think, itself, that are going to lend to his experimentation as he's seeking to understand the ultimate questions of life. And so the sun becomes kind of an interesting first example in here. And I think that this is important as we start thinking about maybe some of the mistakes that are going to be made. Because I think it's important for us to do that. This is coming to us indirectly. And I was thinking, it reminds me of reading like the Screwtape Letters or something like that. We have to look a little deeper to find the good, find the answer. What's wrong here? And one of those things I think that we get right off the bat is the fact that he's going to keep using this phrase over and over, under the sun. And I think every time he uses that phrase, under the sun, that should trigger something in us, because you see someone trying to contain by that. I'm talking about everything under the sun. It's like Carl Sagan when he said, the universe is all there is, was, and ever will be. Trying to get your arms around it and say, okay, we're just talking about within this sphere. Nothing else beyond there matters. We're just going to deal with this reality. Because one of the hopes that we're going to get in understanding this book is, wait, is there a way beyond that sphere? Because you know what? He very well may be right. That if this is all we have to go on, that maybe in the end it is all meaningless. I think Dostoevsky said that, like, if there is no God, then all is permissible. Right? There are no rules. There's nothing that you can do that's wrong or right. So in verse 3, he's talking about what advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun. And in that, it means this sense of profit, that after he does all these things, is there anything remaining, anything left? And for a generation goes and a generation comes, and we're going to get to this later, the idea of the seasons. You know, it's just shifted now, and here we are in the fall. And to go, oh, we love the fall. But we think, God, we've been here before, and we're going to be here again. Tying that also as well into generations and the people that come and go. This earth that is revolving and this cycle that just goes on and on and on. And all of a sudden he starts pointing to the drudgery of that existence. It's kind of a weird thing. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but I've thought this sometimes when I'm really busy. I'll be laying down in bed at night and I'll think, wow, I was just here. Right? Like that the things of that day just flew by, and here I am, like my only pause being at the end of the day as I sit there in bed and go, wow, another day. And the days start rattling off, right? This cycle, and this is life. And we start to see this over and over, the repetition. And how that creates this weariness in us. It just does. And I think that this is really honest, but it's very true. That when we start seeing the repetition daily, over and over, where are we getting? And so he talks about this idea of the wind blowing and blowing in circles. And Carl and I were talking about this in physics. There's this idea that work has to do with like a transference of energy. But if you start here and you end here, how much work has been done? None, right? Zero. And here you go, this wind cycling over day after day after day. The rivers flowing into the sea, and that the sea is not full. And this is a little bit of a shift, but he's kind of continuing this like dismal portrayal of life. Not only is it repetitious, but as these rivers are pouring into the sea over and over, constant flow, the sea is not rising. The rivers are not running out. It's not filling up. And so what you have is just this constant pouring out. It's like sand through a sieve that you can never fill. So in this cycle of life, this constant drudgery, this sense of never being able to actually satiate man's desires. And we'll get into this, that there is like a temporary relief. But the point is that temporary relief is like scratching a mosquito bite, right? And thinking, oh, if I scratch it one more time, maybe it will stop itching. And the fact is, we all know absolutely not. That the more you scratch, the worse the itch becomes. And so in verse 8, he just goes, oh, it's wearisome. That phrase, you know, you hear his exhaustion. Man is not able to tell it. Like, he's just going, I can't even describe it. Just this sense of being completely overwhelmed. And as he's summing these things up, the drudgery, I think that we have to at some point find ourselves at least somewhat sympathetic. To go, wait, do I feel that way? Am I feeling that way? Am I getting caught up in this? Where is like the hopefulness in my heart? Because I think that this is a good indication. As we look at our own hearts, as we look at what is going on here, are we getting swept up in that drudgery? And do we find ourselves trying to medicate ourselves the same way that everybody else is? To distract ourselves away from the problem. To think, you know, maybe what I can do is just get on Facebook and stay there for the next 8 hours and feel like I've somehow attached meaning to my life. Stare at the television, whatever it is, any of these ways of distracting ourselves from the realities of this ongoing, never-ending cycle. You say there's something new. He goes, nah, it's been there before. I immediately think, wait, there's no iPads at this time. See, we've got iPads. There's something new. It's funny, you know, they're talking about the batteries in these cell phones now. You know, on cell phones, we just have not had, like, everybody having a cell phone for that long. I mean, maybe, what, 15 years, maybe? And you can see these photos online of just mountains of cell phones, all with these batteries that in the end are like this hazardous waste. And to go technology, I mean, it's old so fast. This isn't an iPad, it's an iPad 2. And wait, when does the third one come out? And this constant, like, novelty is just so fruitless. But we live under this illusion that if I get the next thing, or maybe I do the next accomplishment, and then everybody will know who I am, and everybody will remember me, and all of a sudden I'll be important. And so we start chasing after these things, that next thing that's going to validate us and tell us, you are good, you are successful, you are of value. And here you've got our wise man saying, nobody's going to remember you. Nobody's going to remember you. It makes me think of, sorry, I'm just kind of giving you some extra commentary. The last service didn't get this. But but Einstein, I love his quote where he says, look, I'm no Einstein. And you're like, even when you're quoting Einstein, it's not Einstein, right? I mean, we just have these conceptions of people, and he's going like, oh my goodness, this cycle, even the ones that we remember, we have no idea who they were. We don't value them. We value their crazy hairstyle or whatever it is. There's nothing new. And gosh, you know, I mean, when we do create something new, we create a tragedy around it. I've heard that Jurassic Park is a metaphor for postmodernism. We can create the dinosaur, but then the dinosaur eats us, just the same way we can create all kinds of fabulous technology, but we bomb each other with it. The problem is deeper. None of us are able to fix this thing through all the things that promise to fix it. And so we get this despair, this angst that comes in. Nobody's going to remember you. There's going to be somebody to replace you in your job. You've seen that movie About Schmidt. I love that movie that Jack Nicholson is retiring, and he's got this box of basically constitutes all his life's work. And the next guy pitches it. And he's just heartbroken. He's given his whole life to this, and he gets a pen and a little party and nothing. The author, the wise man, is saying, okay, think about that. Think about that and then think how you're spending your life. Are you seeking meaning in your job? Are you seeking meaning in your success? Are you seeking it in that next thing that you want to get? Because it doesn't produce. In the end, you're going to stand there with that thing you sought and realize it's empty. So we shift gears here to verse 12. New voice comes in. The preacher, now speaking first person, says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. Heavy statement right there. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over at Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I realized this also is striving after wind. Because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. It's kind of an interesting title in verse 12 that he gives himself king over Israel in Jerusalem. And very few would say that actually very few kings actually were the king over Israel in Jerusalem. I think there's two, David and Solomon. And so he says that in 16, over all the kings that have gone before me. And I think there's a sense that this may be a king later who's coming back in and taking that role of Solomon. Clearly the man who had exceeded all others in wisdom and in wealth. And so in 16, that becomes his claim for authority. Like, you think you've experienced this, trust me. I'm further along, and this is what it amounts to. I remember saying this to the high school kids when I was a youth pastor, saying, you guys are a step ahead of everybody. Because everybody thinks when they get here, they're going to be happy. And you guys all know that's not true, right? Here you live in one of the most beautiful places, and everybody's thinking, oh, if I could just be there. And you go, not deep enough, right? You're there, and you realize, nope. And so we live in a community, I mean, that is as distracted, if not more distracted, than anybody else, trying to tell ourselves that everything's okay, that we really are happy. That's another Pascal idea, as he says, when the king is unhappy, like, you know you're in trouble. The king has everything, and he's turning to the court jester saying, take my mind off of this, right? And I think sometimes that we have a little bit of a unique perspective that, you know, in all the terrible sufferings going on in the world, the worst kind of suffering, according to a lot of these people, is boredom and loneliness, because it's inescapable. The other, you could find meaning, but in all that, what they would refer to as like the malaise of life is just despair. He gives a couple proverbs here that I think are really, really great. I mean, who knows whether or not these are his own, possibly. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. And I think there's so much wisdom in that. I love this phrase. I mean, when we talk about the fall of man, we talk about the curse. And I think that that's right, that there's a poison that entered into man's hearts all the way back in Adam and Eve and their poor decision to eat the forbidden fruit. And I like this word, though, that it's bent. And I think that's such a great term in thinking about the world that we live in. What's wrong? And this, people have this understanding, something is wrong with the world. And sometimes broken is almost too strong of a word, because we still function and we still operate, and yet we walk with this constant limp. There's this bend, and it's like trying to straighten a piece of metal if you've ever tried. You just can't. You can never get it back. And sometimes this seeking after success or seeking after pleasures is like trying to make life straight again, and we just can never do it on our own. And then he's going to talk about there at the second part of that, what is lacking cannot be counted. And this is just the sobering reality of this, that all of these things, including that next thing that you're going to go after, isn't going to satisfy you. So just stop, right? This is, I think, going to be one of the healthiest things as we are seeking to break idols, is when God lays those things on our heart that we're striving after. He begins by just saying, okay, stop doing that. Stop seeking after that. If you can know ahead of time, if I buy this next thing, I'm not going to be any happier than I am right now. Wow, there's wisdom right there. Most people don't even want to think about that, right? We'll just purchase it in hope. But it's a false hope. In verse 18, this idea of pursuing wisdom, pursuing knowledge, leads to this place of increased pain. I think this is true as well. That I think there is a false sense of comfort in avoiding the realities of life. I think we're pretty good at doing that too. The idea of when something heavy comes on the news, we're like, click, next channel. A way of like, just going, I don't want to hear that. With knowledge, I mean, this, I joke with Patty about this, because she has a tendency to want to go to movies that are a little heavier at times, right? And I always say, oh, why do you do that to yourself? But what I'm really saying is like, I want to pretend that that's not out there. Right? I don't want to go see a movie that's going to remind me of like how bad racism was in our country or the abuses that we've done in the past. I want to just pretend that we didn't do that and that everything is okay. Oh my gosh, like, what an escape from reality. How do you change anything when that's your posture? But it's so easy to do, to go, look, increasing wisdom is going to bring pain. So therefore, don't increase in wisdom. And this is what I think that we can learn, kind of as we're wrapping up our little introduction here. Because some of you are probably thinking, why am I going to come for the next 3 months to hear this Sunday after Sunday? I think to get this is right at the heart of what we're here to do. I've heard Ecclesiastes is the alternative to everything else that the Bible is offering, right? You can have this, you can have the answer, you can have the truth, or you could have this, the striving after wind. There's a great line from, it's actually from one of the new Sherlock Holmes movies, but where it says, Mr. Holmes, you must widen your gaze. I'm concerned you underestimate the gravity of coming events. And this is, I think, one of the first mistakes that we can learn here from the preacher, is that his gaze is too small. And we're supposed to understand this, that under the sun is too small a sphere, right? Widen your gaze. And Jesus is going to say this, Paul is going to say this, to just go, set your minds on things above, not on things below. Right? That what good is it to gain the whole world and forfeit your soul? And we're constantly being pulled outside of this into a timeline of eternity, of the cosmos. That's David, like he's just saying, look, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. And to go, don't get stuck looking down. Keep your eyes up and you'll see. The second mistake that I think he makes is that he experiments with sin as if you could somehow remain objective. And this is just a huge lie. Sin is not like that. Sin doesn't just bring its own consequences, but it contaminates, it poisons. It's like cancer. And so we may be able to freely choose A or B and feel really good about that, but if B is sin, what it's going to affect is not just the pain that it brings with it, but it's going to affect our next choice and weaken our will and weaken our joy, weaken our life, make us less and less of a person, make us more and more empty. And so I think this is an important realization here, that you have a guy that went, hey, you know what, I decided to experiment with women, or experimented with wealth, or experimented with possessions. And he's going to go, and they all turn to vanity. Well, no wonder you have a guy at the end who's completely robbed of every bit of joy of life. Because in the pursuit of those things, life erodes. Pursuit of those things, our heart shrinks and dies. And so I think the second thing that we can learn is the consequence that man is not in a place to be objective. The fool does not know what foolishness is. Only the wise know what foolishness is, right? Only the wise are able to be able to look with impartiality. The fool is just caught up in his folly. And the third assumption I think that we get there at the end is that he goes, with more knowledge comes pain, and that's bad. And I think that Scripture would teach us something different than that. Scripture would teach us that in pain and in suffering and in difficulty is opportunities to widen our gaze, to see beyond the constraints of this day or this month or this lifetime into what truly is eternal, what is truly of value. I'm really hoping that as we're going through this, that we sit in it. As St. Teresa says, sit in your weeds, right, Tony? Tony told me that earlier this week. I love that. I think as we go through this book, we sit in our weeds. What this means is we don't pick out the tops of all the leaves and leave those roots in there to just grow back, right? Sometimes we do this with our sin. We manage it. Sitting in your weeds is allowing God to come in and do the work, allowing God to come uproot these things in us, to realize that our questions, we can press into those questions. And I hope that you take advantage of this in the Bible studies that are happening throughout the week as well. That these are not places to come and be bombarded with answers. These are places to come in and struggle and to wrestle, because this is how we grow. And you know, I love what Jay is sharing about the prayer ministry, as he's saying, take an hour a week. I promise you, if you don't have an hour a week to pray, that you are diverting your attention away from something, right? Trying to prove some level of success or accomplishment that we can't take an hour. One of my favorite quotes from Kierkegaard, he says, if I were a physician and if I were allowed to prescribe just one remedy for all the ills of the modern world, I would prescribe silence. For even if the word of God were proclaimed in the modern world, how could one hear it with so much noise? Therefore, create silence. And I hope that we can, during this time, really seek to quiet our hearts and be honest, really honest with God. Not just tell him the things we think he wants to hear. I read somewhere, somebody said, it's a brave man that first suggested this book be canonized in the Bible, right? And who knows the story? We don't have that history. But somebody said, no, this is important for us to struggle with. This is important for us to wrestle with. To ask yourself this question, this is one that my friend Lynn is always telling me, as I'm talking to her about some sort of struggle or some sort of difficulty, she says, where is God in that, Jeff? And often I go, gosh, I don't know, because I'm not looking. I'm caught up in the circumstances of this, or I'm caught up in my own self-pity, that I don't realize God is there. He's with me in these situations. He's with me in the dark places. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, he's with me. And he comforts. So as we sit in this book, as we press in to what God is doing in our hearts, I pray that we're able to see him amongst the weeds, that we don't get stuck in this cycle of trying to make everything okay, but we're able to sit in the questions and allow God to show us just how deep the answer really is. And so I want to close this with a familiar verse from Psalm 139. In 23 and 24, it says, search me, O God, know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. Amen.